When Anthy returned, carrying a small bag over one shoulder and Makoto on the other, she found Utrina knotting the ends of the sash neatly at her waist, just below the folded pouch where Annabelle was tucked securely against her chest, facing her. Corwin was standing back, looking impressed, while Jinora fussed with the details, precisely arranging the way the wide, many-folded fabric lay on Utrina's shoulders and back. There's also a version of this method with which you can secure her to your back, which is useful if you need your hands free, and more comfortable for long stints, particularly once she starts to get a bit heavier, Jinora explained as she tidied up the folds over Utrina's left shoulder. That's probably the one you and Corwin will be using most often, but I thought it best to start with this one. She smiled slightly. The other is a more advanced technique. Thanks, Jinora, said Utrina, twisting her waist this way and that, then raising her arms a couple of times. All right? She asked Annabelle, who made a sound that might have been approval. Garnet coiled around Utrina's neck and draped her head over one of her shoulders, looking down at their infant charge. She seems comfortable enough. Are you sure this thing is safe? She's quite secure, I assure you, said Jinora. This technique has been used for thousands of years all over the world. Iki and I carried all our children this way, and never once dropped any of them, even when sorely provoked, she added with an arch little smile. She double-checked Utrina's knot. Good. There. Snug as a rabaroo, Joey. She smoothed Annabelle's violet hair with a kindly smile. Her first flight. That's a particularly momentous day in the life of an air nomad child. The elderly airbender kissed the infant gently on the head, and then, rather to Utrina's surprise, her bearer on the cheek. Then she wished them all a happy flight and departed. I guess she likes us, Utrina remarked to Annabelle. Then, turning to Anthy, she asked, So, how do we look? Anthy smiled. Very good together, she said. Then, with a slightly arch look at Corwin, she said, Defeated? I'll try again, have no fear, Corwin replied, smiling. Utrina is better at textile management than I am, though. Anthy laughed. Ha ha! You should have known that would be the case, she told him. I'm sure she's told you about the time she made a dress for me out of a tablecloth. Corwin grinned wryly. I always assumed there was a bit of poetic license going on there, he admitted. Wait, did you just call me a liar? Utrina wondered, eyeing him narrowly. No, Elsker, I called you a poet, he said, giving her a kiss. Besides, I'm driving, he added, making both women wonder briefly what that had to do with anything, before they realized he'd gone back to why he wasn't the one wearing the sling. Speaking of which, shall we? Corwin and Mogi led the way for the first leg of the trip, out over the southern corner of Republic City and to the Sato family estate in Future City. There they collected Ryo, who bounded out of the enormous manor house at the sight of the bison landing in the courtyard, carrying with him a small tool bag of the kind used by surveyors and architects. Morning all, he said cheerfully as he clambered up Mogi's side. Reaching the top, he climbed over the gunwale onto the saddle platform itself, put down his bag, and grinned around at his fellow passengers. Good morning, Ryo, said Anthy cheerfully. And how's everybody doing to... Ryo paused, raised a thoughtful finger, lowered it, scratched his chin, and then said chidingly, Now, ladies, this is just not fair to poor old Ryo. Hey, don't look at me. She's the one who cheated, said Utrina, angling a thumb at Anthy with a grin. You weren't complaining before breakfast, my love. Anthy replied serenely, making Uchina snicker and blush. All set back there? Corwin called from the pilot's seat. Corwin? Said Rio. Yeah? Corwin replied. Your ladies are very charming, but your daughter's mother, in particular, passeth understanding, said Rio matter-of-factly, drawing giggles from both. Ha! Tell me something I don't know. Mogi, yip yip! From that point, Rohan took the lead. He guided the little convoy northeastwards, skirting Republic City's sprawling suburbs, then into the jagged and dramatic mountain range that ringed the city. Uchina, now sitting Indian fashion at the front of Mogi's saddle, smiled at the memory of the drive she and Corwin had taken up into these same mountains during their honeymoon, then glanced down to check again how Annabel was taking the aerial experience. She was pleased to see that the baby seemed delighted, looking around as best a person could before she developed much in the way of command of her neck, with no fear or dismay in her emerald-green eyes. Uchina was vaguely surprised to feel none of the misgivings she'd grappled with the previous night attempting a reprise. Being out here with an infant lashed securely to her chest was an utterly unfamiliar experience, and not one she had ever even daydreamed about having. But now that she was doing it, it just seemed right somehow. She still felt emotions she couldn't describe or catalog when she looked down at this tiny person's face, but none of them was alarming or disturbing. It was a very warm and pleasant experience, though she supposed part of the warmth came from Garnet, who had insinuated herself into the wrap as well, and was now, apparently less interested in the aerial experience than her human comrade, fast asleep. She wondered idly if this was what awakening maternal instincts felt like, and decided it probably wasn't. She still didn't feel particularly nurturing. That remained a task best left to people more qualified to undertake it. After mulling it over for a while, she decided that what she felt most was protective. She knew, of course, that mothers felt protective toward their offspring, too. Sometimes epically so, she well remembered Caitlin's nearly going on a rampage once. But there was a difference. She couldn't put a name to it right now, but nor did she feel she had to. She wasn't explaining it to anyone else, after all. Uchina shrugged inwardly and ducked her head to give Annabel a kiss on the forehead. Okay, kiddo, she murmured privately to the child. I can do this. I'm not cut out to be a mom, but your father could be right. I might just be able to handle the dad thing. She didn't get an answer. It would have been more than a little startling if she had, but she liked to think that Annabel didn't mind the idea. A moment later, she felt Anthy's hand on her shoulder. Turning, she saw her wife settling down alongside her with a smile. You look comfortable, she said, snuggling against Uchina's side. Is she enjoying her flight? Seems to be, Uchina replied. Sensing a change of course, she looked up and saw that Peavy was descending toward one of the mountains, with Mogi turning to follow him. Within a few moments, they had swept through a cut and were skimming over a meadow at the bottom of a short valley, the mountain's crags rising on three sides. Ahead, the valley ended in a jagged cliff face, down which a waterfall streamed into a small, irregularly semicircular lake. Peavy flared and landed near the rocky lakeshore. Corwin set Mogi down alongside him. Wow, said Corwin as he slid down from Mogi's neck. He went aft to help first Anthy, then Uchina descend from the saddle. Rio, his wits recovered, was so gallant as to hand them down from above, then jump down after them. Once regrouped at ground level, they all went around to join Rohan at Iki at the edge of the lake. This is amazing, Uchina agreed, gazing around at the scene. The mountain's gray-blue flanks rose all around them, rearing to snow-capped peaks to left, right, and center. They gave the valley a sheltered, secure feeling. It would only be approachable on the ground from the west, up the coombe that led to it, and even coming in by air from any other direction would be a challenge with that ring of peaks in the way. There was plenty of sunshine, though, the thriving meadow grasses and wildflowers, and the lack of snow in what was, after all, early spring in the mountains, attested to that. They were just below the tree line, with only a few hardy pines standing here and there. And yet, despite the site's splendid isolation, Republic City could still be seen, a distant blur of buildings and streets, down below, rambling down to the bayshore. Uchina guessed that it would be a blaze of golden light at night, far enough away not to be bothersome, close enough to provide a comforting sense of community. In the far distance, just barely visible, she thought she could even make out Air Temple Island itself as a speck on the blue arc of the sea horizon. "Not bad," Rio declared. "Min Min'll be jealous when she sees this. Our mountain retreat hasn't got anything like that view of the city." Rohan beamed like a magician who has just pulled off what he knows is a really good trick. "This is Mount Wei Tang, the Three Brothers," he said, gesturing around them. "So called because of its triple peak. Legend has it they were first climbed by three brothers from Omashu." Anthe smiled in recognition. "The Wei Tang brothers, great explorers from the time of the Western Emperors. I read about them in Avatar Jonggu's History of the Earth Kingdom." Rohan gave her a smiling salute and bow. "You're becoming quite a scholar of our history, Lady Anthe." "I have to congratulate you," Ikki agreed, then grinned and added, "Not everyone has the stomach for the blessed Jongbu's prose. I never got through Volume 1. Uchina walked a couple of paces to the lakeshore, then turned and looked back at the Air Elders with a baffled look. "You're giving us this place? It's... real estate like this must be worth a fortune." "Oh, at least one," Rio put in. "I dare say it may be," Rohan agreed. "But we have little use for money. Jinora and I agreed, once we determined to grant the four..." "Five," said Garnet. "Five of you, one of the central air temple's holdings in the Republic, that it had to be this one. The other parcels we still hold are either too far from the city, too near the city, or so utterly inaccessible that not even we could make worthwhile use of them." "How did the Air Temple come to own such a place?" Anthe wondered. "Grandpa Aang was originally going to build Republic City's new Air Temple up here," Ikki said. "It's a much more typical spot for one than the island. Eventually, though, he decided it was too isolated and grand. Would send the wrong message, like the Air Temple was meant to lord over the city rather than be part of it." "Some say Grand Grand Katara was the one who actually made that decision," Rohan put in with a little smile. Corwin laughed. "Ha ha! I'd believe that," he said, causing the two elders to exchange a slightly puzzled look. "At any rate, the temple was never built," said Rohan. "At various times, one or another of us has given thought to building a retreat up here, but that's never come to pass either." "We believe Grandpa would want you to have it," Ikki concluded. "After all, you're among his next life's dearest friends." Uchina's smile had a dimension it wouldn't have had the day before, as she replied sincerely, "Well, I think I can speak for all of us when I say we're deeply honored, and very grateful, to accept your gift. This is beyond generous. You've all done so much for us in the last few days already." "Great Uncle Sokka once said that if a man doesn't have his family, he has nothing. Hiki said cheerfully, which didn't really seem to be a reply at first. To her distinct pleasure, Utena got there before Anthy for once, giving the airbender a sage little smiling nod a full second ahead of her wife.
"Well, son, what do you say?"
Rio asked Corwin, clapping him on the shoulder. "I brought my tools. Let's survey this bad boy." "No time like the present," Corwin agreed, nodding. "Rohan, Iki, Utena does speak for us in this, I think, but let me just add my own thanks anyway. This is amazing." "And mine as well," Anthy added with an earnest nod. With gracious goodwill all around, Rohan and Iki pitched in to help Rio and Corwin perform a full survey under Garnet's aerial supervision, complete with a set of topographical scans that could later be converted into a holographic mock-up of the entire site, suitable for construction planning. Utena and Anthy sat down on a boulder by the lakeshore and gazed out at the waterfall, smiling at their private thoughts. Presently, both were roused from their parallel reveries as Annabelle stirred, waking from a nap, and began diligently investigating Utena's shirt front. Anthy watched closely, a little smile playing at her lips, to see how her husband would react. To her delight, Utena's response, once she looked down and twigged to what the infant was doing, was to grin wryly and say, "Nope, sorry, kiddo. Barking up the wrong tree there." She reached to her waist and began to untie the knot of her air acolyte wrap. "Himemia, I believe this is your department." Anthy smiled, both at the mirth in Utena's voice and the evidence it represented of a better, easier frame of mind. "I believe it is," she said. Just as they were finishing up the transfer, with the sash in the same configuration, Corwin arrived. He smiled at the sight of Utena in pit crew mode, making sure, as Jinora had for her, that the knot was secure and all the folds and pleats correct. Once all was arranged to specifications, Anthy moseyed off along the lakeshore, talking quietly to Annabelle about how lovely their home was going to be while they took care of business. "I guess you are feeling better," said Corwin with a smile as he and Utena stood by the rock and watched their combined figure recede. "Yeah," Utena agreed. "I don't know as I'm completely done adjusting yet, but it's a lot less..." She considered her phrasing for a second. "Up on top of me than it was last night." She leaned against him, looping an arm around his waist. "I told Annabelle on the way out here, I'm not the mothering kind, but you might be right about the dad thing," she said wryly. Corwin chuckled and leaned down slightly to kiss her. "I'm glad to hear it. Like I told you yesterday morning, I think you'll be good at it." He looked around for a moment, making certain that the survey team didn't need him just now, which they didn't. Iki and Rohan had taken Rio up on Peavey to get a comprehensive aerial scan. Then turned back to Utena, his arm around her shoulders, and said, "While we've got a minute to ourselves, I have something for you." Utena raised her eyebrows. "Oh?" Corwin nodded. "Do you remember when we met Korra's cousin Kemba at the market? She gave you something to give to me." "I've been wondering about that," said Utena with a smile. "I assumed it had something to do with the thing she was giving you a hard time about." "It did," Corwin confirmed. "She thought I might be from the North Pole. See, in the water tribes, it's traditional for a man who hopes a woman will marry him to make a special kind of necklace for her. He carves the necklace with a unique design that identifies it as his work. If she accepts it and wears it, that's an announcement to everyone who sees her that she has chosen him." "Nice," said Utena. "More personal than a diamond ring." "Yeah, the water tribes are big on that," Corwin said. "Historically, they haven't had much in the way of material wealth, There aren't a lot of resources on the ice caps, so they make up for it with a lot of personal investment in the things they make. Utrinna considered certain of her own possessions that had been made by Corwin's hands, and her smile became a little sentimental. "I can see where that's an ethic that would appeal to you," she said. "Probably at least partly where I got it," he agreed. "Anyway, that being the case..." He unfastened one of the top pockets of his wool jacket, reached into it, and removed a small item, then took a step away and turned fully to her, so that he could offer it on an open palm. "I don't expect you to wear it, but I hope you will accept it," he said with a little smile. Across his palm lay a length of blue fabric about an inch wide, the same rich royal blue as the Water Tribe blanket Utrinna had bought from Kemba on that same visit to the Railway Square Market. Affixed to the middle of it was a circular piece of some finely translucent gemstone, similar to the brooch Utrinna remembered on the formal dress Cora had been wearing at their wedding, like a piece of smooth, pale blue ice. This had been carefully carved and polished, its edge notched into a bas-relief of gear teeth. The center, slightly convex, was crossed by the same circled lightning bolt symbol Beldandy had painstakingly drawn on Utrinna's forehead for both wedding attempts. She took it up and examined it closely, a broad smile coming onto her face, then closed her fist around it and hugged him tight, saying quietly, "Corwin, it's beautiful. Thank you." "You're welcome, Utrinna," he replied, returning the hug just as tightly. "I'm glad you like it." "Show me how you put it on," she said, and while Corwin was reasonably sure she could have figured that out for herself, he certainly didn't mind complying. Quickly and deftly, he snugged the necklace gently around her slender throat, choker fashion, and tied the ribbon in a flat bow knot at the back, so that the gem was centered in front. "There," she said with a satisfied smile, touching the gem with her fingertips. "Now I'll at least look like an honest woman to Kemba and Cora," she added with a slightly wicked grin. Back in town, Anne Cross spent the morning training with Azana in a corner of the Zuko Academy's vast main dojo. This was the first time they had done that, instead of going up to the roof or meeting in one of the practice gyms at Shiro Shinobi Arena. It was Anne's first real experience with communal training at all. Her studies with Caitlin were necessarily one-on-one now that Kate's other student had gone walkabout. And even before he had done, Kyuichi Sionji had not exactly been a crowd. Of course, they weren't all training together, strictly speaking. The other students and their instructors were scattered around the huge room in little groups, ranging from pairs like Azana and Anne, up to clusters of four or five, and each group was pursuing its own agenda. Still, all being at work in this same space conveyed a sense of community that Anne hadn't really felt before while training in a martial art. She quite liked it, at least as a change of pace. She would never want to trade her solo sessions with Azana for training in here all the time, but as a special occasion kind of thing, it worked. On the downside, one of those other instructors was Deng, and he would occasionally take a moment out from berating his students in slightly shrill drill instructor Tong Yu to give Azana and her student a baleful glower. But that meant nothing in the grand scheme of things, and Anne found herself fairly well able to tune him out most of the time. She was much more interested in what Ito-sensei and Caitlin-sensei were making of it. They, in turn, were making a great show of not observing, though both Anne and Azana knew very well that they were. The two masters, with Sergei sprawled at their feet, were sitting at a pie show table in the very back of the corner where their students were training, pretending to be so engrossed in their game that they were paying no attention at all. Anne's developing Zanshin, though, told her plainly that her every move was being scrutinized, and Azana clearly had a similar sort of facility. Such was the rapport that they had developed between them, to boot, that each knew the other was aware of it without asking. All in all, a very nice set of feelings, even marred by the occasional searchlight beam sweep of Deng's disapproval.
All right, very good, said Azana, squaring up to trade bows and firebender salutes with her student.
You're coming along in great bounds, Junichan, she went on, smiling. It won't be long before you're taking my place on the fire ferrets.
Don't lay it on too thick, Caitlin cautioned her with a grin. She still needs to be able to get her head through doors.
Anne gave a self-deprecating laugh. No, Sensei, I'm okay. I know she's only joking.
Perhaps, said Ito, but I have to say I'm also impressed. You do learn quickly, and I can sense your respect for the craft. It's a rare thing in someone who comes to it as late as you have.
He smiled. I'm satisfied. If you wish to return this summer and train with Azana, you'll be most welcome. I may even take it upon myself to show you a trick or two, if your Sifu doesn't object to an old man's meddling, he added, his smile becoming a grin.
That depends on whether they're firebending tricks, said Azana wryly, or your infamous practical jokes. I'm not having that.
Ito laughed.
I suspect this young lady could come up with pranks of her own that would leave my feeble repertoire in the shade, he said, giving Anne a wink.
I don't know what you mean, Ito-sensei, Anne replied with unconvincing piety.
Azana smiled fondly at the pair of them.
Right, you. Let's hit the showers and get some lunch before Grandfather corrupts you further, she said, tagging Anne's shoulder.
Ito and Caitlin watched them pass through the side door to the ladies' changing room, then turned to each other and smiled.
Cora was right to send you here, said Ito. She'll be a credit to my granddaughter's name.
I hope so, said Caitlin. Shall we go in search of lunch ourselves?
Let's have one more game before we go, said Ito.
Kate considered that, then nodded.
Very well.
Ito sat back in his chair.
It's your turn to make the first move, he said.
So it is. Kate considered the tiles for a moment, then picked one up and placed it in the exact center of the board.
Ito raised an eyebrow.
He said. I see you favor the White Lotus Gambit.
Firetown, Republic City's original Little Fire Nation district, was one of the city's oldest neighborhoods. Technically speaking, it predated Republic City itself, having been the core of the wartime Fire Nation colony chosen by Avatar Aang and Fire Lord Zuko as the hub of their bold experiment in nation-building, the capital of the United Republic of Nations. While they walked the three blocks from the late Fire Lord's eponymous firebending academy to the Firetown street market,
Azana explained all this to her student. Any firebender from Republic City or the Fire Nation would know it already, but Anne was, after all, from out of town.
Way, way out of town. She liked Republic City, though. That much was obvious from the spring in her step and the brightness of her eyes as she took in the view. Though listening attentively, she was looking around at everything, trying to take it all in. The colorful banners hanging from telephone wires above the streets, the shop fronts, the bustling stalls, all the sights and sounds and smells of a cheerful Friday lunchtime in Firetown. She seemed delighted just to be alive and abroad in such a place as this, on the latest in a long string of beautiful spring days. For her part, Anne had a special reason for her especially buoyant mood today. Yes, Firetown was bright and cheerful and boldly drawn, and yes, it was a lovely day. And yes, if she was honest,
She'd have been happy walking along any reasonably safe street in any reasonably clean city, with this particular person by her side. Today, though, she'd had a thought that colored everything she experienced a special shade of pleasant. That thought, running through her head as they entered the marketplace's first block, had been, "A year ago, I was up to my shoulders in trouble, and usually in filth. Nobody gave a damn about me except the people who wanted to strip away everything that makes me who I am, and use my body as a weapon. I had no idea this amazing world was here, and even if I had, I would never have dared imagine I might come here someday, or that I'd be welcome if I did. And now, 11 months later, here I am." That thought, and the sense of wonder that came with it, were not entirely unfamiliar. She'd experienced them often, with various modifications to the count of time, since she had literally run into the arms of the IPO on Corita last April, and found herself abruptly whirled from the second worst of lives to what she was fairly confident was among the best. The feeling was especially powerful on days like this, though, when vistas opened up before her that she'd never even dared to dream of in the bad old days. Azana guided her to a sidewalk cafe at one corner of the market, where they found an empty table under an umbrella at the back. A waiter came and gave them menus, then whisked off into the attached restaurant to tend to some other bit of business. Anne consulted her menu and found that it was in Kokugo, the very Japanese-like language of the Fire Nation. She could understand a fair bit of spoken Japanese, and speak it a little, but its written form was beyond her. Azana saw the train of thought cross her student's eyes and smiled. "Do you trust me, Junichan?" she asked, a little mischievously. "Of course, Azana-sensei," Anne replied at once, blushing ever so slightly. When the waiter reappeared with a pot of hot tea and a couple of little ceramic cups, Azana handed him back the menus and ordered for both of them. When he had gone again, she turned back to Anne and said, "You're in unusually good form today. Not that your form is ever bad, but there's a special spark about you today." Anne's blush deepened a little. She glanced away, smiling her crooked little smile, and mumbled thanks. "Are you happy to be getting back home?" Azana wondered. "It's normal to get a little homesick, even in a place like Republic City. I often find myself yearning for Shujing at least a little. If only my mother didn't live there," she added with a wry smile. "Not at all," Anne said, and then admitted, "Well, okay, a little. It's not so much that I'm homesick for New Avalon. We just moved there a few months ago. It's not really home to me yet. But I'm looking forward to fourth quarter at school. It'll be nice to see my friends again." She grinned. "And tell them about what an amazing spring break I had. But I know as soon as I'm there, I'll be counting the days until I can get back here." Azana regarded her thoughtfully for a moment, then asked, "May I ask you a personal question, Anne?" "Sure, but only if I get to ask you one first," said Anne with a mischievous twinkle of her own. Azana raised an eyebrow. "Dare I even wonder what you want to know?" "Very well, fair's fair. Ask me anything you like." "Why does Karana call you Princess sometimes?" To Anne's delight, it was Azana's turn to go a little red, as with a faintly embarrassed little smile she replied, "Well, there's a tale attached to that. Do you remember when you asked me if I was related to Fire Lord Zuko?" Anne nodded. "Mm-hmm." "Karana is convinced, or claims to be convinced, that I am," said Azana. She paused to take a sip of tea, then went on, "She nearly got us arrested in Caldera City once for demanding that we be admitted to the royal palace in the middle of the night on the grounds that I was the rightful Fire Lord."
She rolled her eyes slightly at the memory. That took some fast talking to get out of. Anne couldn't help giggling at the image.
How did you get out of it?
I may have claimed that she had suffered a head injury, said Azana thoughtfully. Then she shook her head. I don't really remember. I was none too sober myself. She sighed nostalgically. Ah, those were wilder days. Before we had professional reputations to look out for. Then, after taking another sip, she said, Zuko had a younger sister named Azula. She's the great enigma of the Fire Nation's royal family, but that's neither here nor there. The point is, Karana thinks I resemble her. Her wry smile returning, she added, It's the one thing about which she agrees with Mother, in fact. Mother wanted to name me Azula when I was born, but Father wouldn't have it. She touched one of her long, center-parted bangs, which hung to her jawline and framed her face attractively, and said, I do wear my hair similarly most of the time, I admit. With a self-deprecating little smile, she added, My own little touch of vanity, I suppose. Say what you like about Princess Azula. All the artists of the age agree she was a very beautiful girl. Even the ones going out of their way to depict her as a monster, which should tell you something. Anne looked intrigued. Tell me more about her? She asked. There's not a lot to tell, really, Azana replied. As I said, she's the royal family's great mystery. She's said to have been brilliant, but unstable and cruel. She backed their father against Zuko in the brief civil war that ended the Hundred Year War, and it's said that she lost her mind when they were defeated. Not long after the war, she disappeared. Some of Zuko's detractors claimed he'd had her killed, or banished her to some spirit's forsaken corner of the world, because she was a threat to his rule, or simply an embarrassment to the family. Azana shook her head. I doubt that myself. My senior thesis in school was a biography of Zuko. She reddened slightly again, then admitted, As a girl, I was a bit in love with him. As such, I did a great deal of research, and I came to the conclusion that, in spite of everything, he loved his sister, missed her, and always regretted that they were enemies, that their father's malign influence had poisoned their childhoods and turned them against each other. The waiter arrived with their starters then, forestalling further investigation. When he had gone, Anne asked, Did anyone ever find out what happened to her? Azana folded her hands on the table before her and said with a knowing little smile, I think you're stalling in hopes that I'll forget my question. Of course not, Anne protested. I'm just interested. Go ahead, ask. How did you come to be with Master Caitlin in the first place? Azana wondered. She's not related to you, is she? I wouldn't ordinarily pry, she said. But if we're going to spend the summer together, we should probably get to know one another better. And I get the impression that there's much more to your story than a chance meeting with Avatar Korra. Anne had begun to blush again in the course of that disclaimer. Now she hesitated, covered it by sipping her own tea, and then said slowly, That's fair. Sorry, It's just that I don't know quite where to start. Have you heard of the Psi Corps? She had, as it turned out, but only vaguely. The Corps was a matter for the big universe to contend with, and Azana only knew it as one of the things the Ministry for Interstellar Relations maintained a constant vigil against. From that and the fragmentary things she'd heard, she had gathered that dealing with it was not an experience to be sought. She hadn't quite realized how bad it was, though, until Anne explained, in slightly subdued tones, about the policy of universal conscription, her own narrow escape, and the relentless way in which she had been hunted for her rare and powerful talents. and the use to which she had been told, to her face, those talents would be put if and when they caught her.
"That's horrible," Azana said. "It's nothing but..."
She hesitated, frowning, and shook her head.
"I was going to say nothing but slavery, but it's really very much more than simple slavery, isn't it? It's a total negation of selfhood. It's revolting."
Azana reached across the table and placed a cool, gentle hand on Anne's where it lay slack beside her teacup, making the girl glance up from her pensive reverie, startled, and blush slightly once more.
"I'm so sorry to have dragged that out of you when you were having such a good day," she said. "I'm afraid I've completely ruined the mood."
Anne's crooked smile returned as she said,
"It's okay. It's a bad memory. Actually, it's a lot of bad memories. But they lead to good ones."
So saying, she began the next part of her narrative, outlining her rescue at the hands of the IPO and the brilliant new life she'd found herself thrust into. From there, she came to her first valiant summer, her friendship, first through Caitlin and then in their own right, with Corwin and Utna, and on to her meeting with Cora at their wedding, and Azana knew the rest.
"And here we are," said Anne, her good humor fully restored.
She ate a bite of the starter Azana had selected for her, eyebrows going up.
"This," she declared, "is amazing. I don't know what it is, but it's amazing."
"It's," Azana began, but before she could say what it was, someone abruptly slid into one of the vacant seats at their circular table, to Azana's left and Anne's right.
"Good afternoon, ladies," the new arrival said in a smooth, pleasant voice. He was a tall, slim young man, maybe Azana's age, maybe a little bit older, with similar coloring, a Fire National, or a Republican with mostly Western ancestors. He was dressed well, but gaudily, in a three-piece suit of slightly too bright red and black satin, with a brick-red shirt and a bolo tie whose clasp was an enameled medallion with a symbol similar to that on the Fire Nation flag. Besides the tie, he had an ostentatious gold watch chain across his waistcoat and a lot of gold-rim mother-of-pearl buttons, and wore what looked like snakeskin cowboy boots. He had his hair in a pompadour, slicked up with something shiny and smelling powerfully of musk, and his easy, lazy smile revealed a couple of gold teeth.
"Kaiten," said Azana, a porcelain mask of cool civility dropping over her face like a blast shutter.
"Curiously, I don't remember inviting you to join us."
"Now, princess, that's no way for you to be," said Kaiten smoothly.
Azana's eyes narrowed fractionally, the only outward sign of the resentment that welled up in her. So powerful Anne could feel it from her seat as clearly as she could smell Kaiten's reeking hair goop.
"Don't call me that," she said sharply.
Kaiten drew back slightly as if in surprise, then grinned insincerely.
"Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Only your chunky little pal from the South Pole gets to call you that, right?"
He spread his hands in a gesture of mocking surrender. Anne noticed that his nails were varnished the same red as his suit, saying in a conciliatory purr,
"Won't happen again, baby. Won't happen again."
Well-dressed and well-groomed Kaiten might be, but Anne's street-honed instincts instantly caught a whiff of wrongness about him, quite apart from the eye-watering pong of his pomade. He was sharp-featured, just on the right side of what could be called rat-faced, and somehow the gauntness of his narrow cheeks seemed a bit unnatural. His nose didn't quite look in proportion to his face, like the noses of mummies Anne had seen in books. His eyes were that stereotypical firebender amber, but murky, without the sharp clarity of Azana's, and one was open ever so slightly wider than the other.
and would have instinctively disliked him anyway, on the basis of his oily manner, his fake smile, his central casting gangster clothes, his intrusive rudeness, Azana's obvious distaste, and the fact that he called women who obviously did not like him baby. But those little details set her fight-or-fly response to yellow alert. This guy is on something, she thought. Maybe he's not high right this minute, but he's definitely a junkie. He could go off any second. She wished there were some way she could communicate this intelligence to Azana, but her telepathic power was far too weak to convey an understandable message even to another teep, let alone a non-telepath. All she could do was give her Sifu a vaguely alarmed look, tilting her eyes meaningfully toward their uninvited lunch guest, and hope she'd get the idea that Anne wasn't just generally freaked out, but wary of him for a very specific reason. Unfortunately, though they had developed quite a good rapport in the short time they had known each other, it was not yet operating on that sort of instinctive level old friends achieve, and so Azana seemed to miss the nuance. She only nodded slightly, as if to tell her student not to worry, she'd handle it, then said coldly to Kaiten, "You will note at this point that I am not asking you whether I can help you." "That's okay, baby. I'm not here looking for help with anything," said Kaiten casually. "Fact of the matter is, I'm here to help you." "I find that extremely unlikely," Azana replied. "Unlikely or not, it's true. In fact, you might think about showing me a little gratitude, or at least a little respect. I stuck my neck way out for you." Drawing himself up with a broad grin, he spread his hands grandly as if pulling off a magic trick and said, "Thanks to my intervention, the boss has decided to give you one last opportunity to join us." Azana gave him a flat, cold look for a moment, then decided not to dignify that remark by even responding to it, instead returning her attention to her starter. "Go ahead, think it over for a minute," said Kaiten magnanimously. "Oh hey, your lunch is here, even better." He collared the waiter, who had attempted to deliver their dishes and beat a quick retreat, and said, "Hey, don't run off, pal, I haven't ordered yet." "Kaiten will not be joining us," Azana contradicted him. "Sure I will," Kaiten said, his tone remaining light and casual. Anne could see, and feel, that the waiter was utterly terrified. The man had broken a sweat, and he flinched outright as Kaiten reached up and patted his cheek. "Just bring me what the kiddies having," Kaiten added. "And put the whole thing on my tab, will ya?" "That is not," Azana began, but the waiter stammered, "Of course, Mr. Kaiten, right away." With an apologetic look at Azana, he turned and scurried back to the kitchen. "Kinda rude of you to put that poor sap in such a bad position," Kaiten observed. "I mean, on the one hand, he wants to make every customer happy. But on the other hand, his boss knows better than to cross one of us," he said, flicking a thumb against the medallion of his bolo tie. "Of course," he went on, "we wouldn't be at cross purposes if you'd just relax that stiff neck a little." He leaned back in his chair, hooking one arm carelessly over the high back. "Come on, baby. You know it's the right thing to do. A person with your background, your talent, your bloodline, you belong with us." He grinned at her in what Anne figured he probably thought was a seductive way, and went on, "Joining the Agni Kai is your patriotic duty." Anne had heard of the Agni Kai, and its appearance in this context gave her an added pulse of concern about where the conversation was heading. It was the name of a traditional firebender dueling form, yes, but it was also the name of one of Republic City's triads, the criminal gangs against which the Republic City Police fought a constant low-grade war, often with Cora's assistance. She wasn't sure how many there were. In the course of the week's conversations, mainly with the fire ferrets, she had heard the names of three or four, but she had formed the impression that the Agni Kai was among the worst. Azana was unmoved by Kaiten's appeal to her love of country. She sipped her tea, put down the cup, and said simply, "Ha." "Don't you want your countrymen to have a fair chance in this city?" Kaiten inquired. "Or do you like seeing us kept down by the dirt merchants and ice babies?" Azana's eyes flicked to his face, just for a moment, then away again. "Those of us who conduct ourselves like decent people are doing just fine, thank you," she said. She ate a bit of her lunch, and Anne had to admire the way she did it. Even that simple, mundane act seemed like a dismissal. Something in the way she handled her chopsticks, perhaps, elegant and precise, or the very pointed way in which she barely ever looked at him, and then never for more than a half second. It was the most poetically administered cold shoulder Anne could remember witnessing. Unfortunately, it was entirely lost on Kaiten, who shook his head, his glib facade beginning to slip just a bit. "Should have known that wouldn't shift you," he said, sounding faintly disgusted. "You're practically an ice baby yourself these days." Then his grin returned and he said, "Okay, here's something else to think about. We got a new thing. Coming in from out west. It's going to give us the upper hand in this town, baby, once and for all. And I'm offering you a chance to get in on the ground floor. You don't want to help your own people, fine, but you're a smart gal. You can at least see the value in being on the winning team. Yeah? Oh, and just incidentally?" The grin widened, becoming just a little salacious. "It is one hell of a rush." Azana unhurriedly finished the culinary operation she was engaged in, put her chopsticks down next to her plate, and turned an icy glare to him. "You're wasting your time, Kaiten," she said. "More importantly, you're wasting my time. I have no more intention of discussing this matter with you now than I have had on any of the other occasions when you've seen fit to pester me about it. Now go away and leave me alone." When he didn't move, she stood up, dropped a few yuan on the table, having no intention of letting Kaiten buy her lunch, even a lunch he had ruined, and made to leave herself. "Come on, Juniper, we'll go somewhere else. The feng shui in this place is all wrong today." Kaiten's lazy arrogance turned suddenly into something not too removed from fury. Bolting to his feet, he seized her forearm before she could step past him and lean toward her, his muddy eyes boring into hers. "Now you listen here, little princess, and you listen good," he growled, all the oily charm gone from his voice. "You've gotten away with disrespecting the triad before now because the boss was afraid of the old man and the avatar. But that's all over now. We don't need to worry about Ito anymore. We don't have to worry about anybody anymore." "Let go of me, Kaiten," said Azana, meeting his gaze unflinchingly. "Now." "Not this time, princess," Kaiten replied, leaning so close Azana had to lean back a bit to avoid being touched by his nose. "It's time for you to quit acting like you're better than us and do the right thing. The game's entering a new stage, and there ain't room for loose pieces on the board no more. You'll either join us, or we take you out of play. You get me?" Then, glancing to the side, he seemed to notice Anne. A sardonic version of his fake smile stealing onto his face, he turned back to Azana and added, And the same goes for the kid, if she's any good.
Azana's face flushed scarlet. She'd been perfectly willing to let him make remarks about her all day. It wasn't worth even breaking a sweat over. But her student was another matter. Part of her reflected wryly that this was rather ironic behavior, considering that a week ago she hadn't thought she even wanted to be a teacher, but the rest was too furious to find the humor in it. Her free hand flashed to the table, picked up her partly emptied teacup, and dashed its remaining contents into Kaiten's face. It wasn't particularly hot any longer, having been cooling for the better part of his sales pitch, but the suddenness of it startled him. He recoiled, crying out with expected rather than actual pain, and released her arm. She took a step back, putting the cup down, and told him in a coldly precise voice full of falsely cordial loathing, "Kaiten, you were not invited to join us. You are not welcome at our table. Your manner is offensive, your remarks are inappropriate, and your criminal enterprise does not interest me in the slightest." She waited for him to finish wiping tea out of his eyes, so she could be entirely sure of his undivided attention, and then fixed him with her amber glare and went on, "Now get out of my sight. If ever you choose to approach me again, or if you so much as think about my student at any future point, then you will learn what the phrase Agni Kai really means." "Oh, don't do that," thought Anne, but it was far too late. Kaiten's response was to gather himself up with exaggerated dignity, straightening his lapels and brushing droplets of tea from his shirt front. Then he pulled the item at the end of his watch chain from his waistcoat pocket, revealing that it wasn't a watch, but rather a small silver vial. With the casual ease that spoke of long practice, he held the vial in his left hand, unscrewing it with thumb and forefinger, then tipped a quantity of some bright red powder from it onto his right fist, into the crook at the base of his thumb. Raising his right hand to his nose, he closed his eyes and inhaled violently. Keeping his eyes closed, he screwed the vial carefully shut and replaced it in his waistcoat pocket, then licked the residual powder off his hand. "Ah," he said, giving a sort of full-body twitch. If a person could shiver only once, Anne figured it would look something like that. Around their table, people began edging away. They'd started drawing attention when Azana had risen and Kaiten had jumped up to confront her, and a couple of people had actually applauded when she'd thrown her tea in his face, but everybody in the vicinity could sense the vibe going bad now. "That could have something to do with the giant hit of some obvious drug he just did," Azana remarked wryly to herself. She edged around the table toward Azana, but her teacher, looking more and more alarmed now, waved her back. Kaiten opened his eyes. Their pupils had all but disappeared, but Anne was mildly startled to see that the murkiness had gone from the irises. They were now jarringly bright, their color so exaggerated they almost seemed to be glowing orange. "Bad play, princess," he said, and then he snapped into a fighting stance and launched an enormous gout of fire across the space between them.